to it, so you're worried about that. What, some other reactions to this?
Where is it coming from? Where is the arsenic coming from?
Okay. And like, any other thoughts about it?
Arsenic, mountain climbers used to use it as a stimulant.
Arsenic?
Yeah. So.
Yeah, there's some interesting things. I mean, arsenic is actually used as a treatment. I believe it's used as a treatment for heartworm in pets to some extent. It's kind of an interesting thing where the idea is to kill off the heartworm before you kill off the host. So it's a little bit like chemotherapy in that regard too, yeah. But you know, it's something. Any other reactions to this particular title?
How prevalent?
Yeah. Well, thank you. So water is very, very personal to us for obvious reasons. We have a very emotional reaction to it because, you know, we can't live without water. And unfortunately, most of the pollutants that you have in water, you can't see them. And so there's a fear factor, there's an emotional factor to it where you can't see it. A lot of times, like with arsenic, you can't taste it. You don't really have any, you know, you have to rely on a little bit of faith. Anytime you take a drink of water, there's faith that involved in taking that drink of water. And something like arsenic sort of taps into all those kinds of fears because you know it's toxic, you can't taste it, you can't see it, and so you have to rely on some other kind of information to tell you whether or not you should be worried about it. But your reaction to this title here is very anthropocentric. I think most of you are probably thinking about this as like, it's in my drinking water. Well, what if we change that a little bit? Your lake water has arsenic. Now what? How do you react to that one?
Same thing. Well, we live by Lake Michigan, so mm-hmm. I would think about that.
But what are your main concerns at this point now?
Swim.
Fish.
Okay, so now you're thinking about swimming, now you're thinking about fishing, anything else?
But the water supply, your drinking supply, frequently comes from a lake.
It could, yeah. It could. So there's still a chain back to your perspective on it. How about that? Your irrigation water has arsenic. Now what?
Vegetables.
Okay. So we're still bringing it back around to its impact on us, for sure. So there's still kind of a very anthropocentric concept here about what happens, and you know, arsenic is something that can get into plant tissue. I mean, plants will take it up. It is possible that it can be in your food supply, and it's very likely that it's in your food supply. How about this one? Now, how do you react to it?
It's naturally occurring.
Oh, it is naturally occurring for sure. But how do you react to it now? So this is a wildlife preserve. There's probably no drinking water coming out of this. You're not going to swim in it. You're not probably going to fish in it. How do you react to this?
Does it build up in as you go up the food chain?
It can, to some extent. It's not like mercury. It's not like some of the heavy metals. It's kind of a weird metal in that, or a weird element in that sense, is that it's has some both metallic and non-metallic properties to it. So it's kind of, you know, it kind of crosses, spans some gaps.
It affects me less because I could choose not to go there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, going there and just looking, it's probably not going to affect you at all. And so, I mean, this is a situation here where, you know, the impact is going to be on ecology. The impact is going to be on wildlife. There's a different thing at play here where you're not drinking it. This is something that's happening not involved with humans in particular. This has some ecology aspects of it. So there's, you know, when I teach my water quality class here, or at University of California, Davis, I guess I should introduce myself. I haven't done that. So many of you are familiar anyway. My name is Peter Hernes. I'm at University of California in Davis, and I teach water chemistry type courses. When I teach my water quality class, it's to non-science majors, and one of the emphasis on the class there is that this is the kind of title you might get in the media when you get a newspaper article. This is kind of the level there. I mean, they're trying to generate interest in some newspaper article or television or whatever else. They're trying to get you to read And this is, this, you know, your emotions are fair game to them. They can very readily pick on your emotions and get you hooked with something like this. And what I try to do with my class is I try to give them a bigger, more holistic perspective of what any kind of pollutant is, what water quality is. And so I guess that's my what I'd like to start here with is a definition. How would you guys define water quality?
Pure and safe.
Safe for humans and animals.
Safe for consumption.
And how? Safe, I mean, how do you want to broaden that at all, or what do you want to do?
No detrimental health effects in an ideal situation.
Okay, so no health effects.
I would rather have a continuous variable rather than a true false. Mm-hmm. So I would say your water quality somehow is a function of impact upon life in that ecosystem.
Okay.
Like on a continuum.
So what do you make of the fact that there's water quality concerns and water quality standards in Lake Tahoe that have nothing to do with life? It's just how clear the water is. People are all up in arms. They're putting all sorts of regulations in place. There, you know, meetings. There's funding. There's studies. There's best management practices. There's all sorts of stuff going on up at Lake Tahoe, just to keep the water clear. That has nothing to do with human health. That's some water up there, even right now, with some pollution, it is some of the purest, cleanest water you can get anywhere. So how do you factor that into this concept of water quality? Because it's a water quality driven issue up at Lake Tahoe.
Is it only for aesthetic?
Yeah, pretty much. It's just aesthetics.
Mm-hmm. But Lake Tahoe is not about aesthetics. I mean, that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's about tourism.
Well, yeah, I mean, aesthetics.
Right, it's about money, ultimately.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could make the same kind of argument about national parks, bodies of water in national parks, and arguably those are not driven by tourism. I mean, although we all freely admit that tourism is playing more and more of a role in those than it used to be, because the funding, federal funding, is going down, and that's one of their ways that they can make ends meet is by bringing in tourism. But the original concept of the national park was just to preserve things for aesthetic purposes. And, you know, nobody wants to go to a river to a national park like, you know, Yosemite, where the rivers are flowing brown with garbage and things like that. I mean, nobody wants to go to an alpine lake and see that it's eutrophied. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Tahoe is probably driven quite a bit by tourism, but the national parks, maybe not so.
I've never been to Tahoe, but it seems like maybe at one time it was clear. I think anytime there's a change, especially something as dramatic that you can see it,
mm-hmm.
People are concerned about what it means.
Right.
Whether they know what it means or not, they know something has changed, and that's an alarm bell.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some quality of stability that I think we're looking for also in our ecological systems.
Yeah, probably so. Yeah, I mean, you know, you could argue that we should put more nutrients into Lake Tahoe because then it would support more fish and more wildlife and more lots of other things than it does right now. It's pretty oligotrophic. It's kind of a dead lake in that sense. Well, so anyway, this concept of water quality, you know, you really can't start to define it until you know what it's used for. So your water has arsenic. Well, if it's used for drinking water, then that's got a certain kind of, you know, that's got certain implications to it in terms of, you know, that's the beneficial use. There's going to be certain standards associated with it, certain kind of protocols that you follow, and then, you know, the Clean Water Act will treat it in a certain way. If the issue is aesthetics, then there's going to be a whole other set of water quality standards in play. If the issue is irrigation, yet another one. There's a number of different beneficial uses, and so water quality really can't be defined until you kind of know who the what the beneficial use is, but more broadly, it's defined relative to the stakeholders. So the first thing that I have my class do if they saw a newspaper article like this that's got a title like that is I ask them to identify the stakeholders. Because once you know who the stakeholders are, then it starts to become a lot easier to talk about arsenic. So let's just say the stakeholders in this case is for our, I guess, well, I'll call them water drinkers. So it's a lot easier to start to define the concept of water quality with arsenic now that you know that the stakeholders are water drinkers. Skin exposure, there can be some issues with that as well. I'm not sure, the science doesn't seem to be, or at least I haven't been able to find as much information about just the topical effects, but it's generally not considered to be very, it's not the main route of exposure that's concerning, it's the ingestion part that's the most concerning about it.
Yeah, it runs through my mind is the BPH controversy where the chemical industry scientists said it's perfectly fine, no problem at all. The other side, of course, and that enters into anything. We're talking about the arsenic.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about who are the stakeholders on the science side.
Well, on the science side, I mean, okay.
I realize we're finding a boogeyman behind every bush, but...
Well, we'll just jump right into that part, too, so... So the institutions, that's kind of the fourth part that we talk about in our class. So, when I have them read, in the exams, I'll have them read a newspaper article, I'll have them tell me who the stakeholder is, I'll have them tell me what science they can find in there, and I'll ask them what science is missing. Which is sort of the really interesting question, because usually there's an awful lot of science that's missing for these things, including just any numbers. We talked about the 37 versus 50 versus 10. You'd be amazed at how often articles don't even have that kind of information. They just tell you that there's something there. They don't tell you how much. They don't tell you how much is safe. It's amazing to look at the kind of coverage that things like that get in the media. So I'll have them pick out stakeholders, I'll have them pick through the science, and then give me some, tell me what science is missing that we really need to know. And then I'll ask them, the policy that's in place that sort of covers certain aspects of the water quality. And then the last thing that we talk about, I guess, is the boogeyman, the institutions that are doing this stuff. So most of this kind of research here is coming either directly through EPA scientists or university studies. Studies. My spelling sucks. USGS is a big one as
Institute
well.
Institute of Health, are they into it?
Yeah, Institute of Health would be. And states will have their own. So there's a number of federal organizations. There's a number of state organizations. For the most part, I'm the first one to admit that government organizations, university organizations, that there are agendas. I mean, individuals will have certain agendas in there, and so, for the most part, I think they have the good intentions are there, and for the most part, folks are trying to do their best. Part of the institution stuff is industry. So if it's a chemical that's coming straight out of the industry and the industry is the one that's funding most of the research there, yeah, then you probably need to, that's a piece of information that you would want to know if you're looking at a newspaper article, for sure. So that's one of the questions that you want to know in a newspaper article is like, what are the institutions? So you want stakeholder science, policy institutions, and those are really the four kinds of, all those pieces of information that you really need to get a holistic perspective on the water quality issue and know how concerned you need to be and what kind of actions could be taken. Okay, so let's say you've got 37 parts per billion of arsenic in your water. That the maximum contaminant level is 10. What's next? What are your options? Well, I mean, one of the things, I guess, your option is to, there's a few things that you would want to know, I guess.
I mean, one thing might be, why did they change the standard? Was it because they discovered that it was misplaced in the first place? Or, like you suggested, it really didn't make any difference in more in health, but it was just convenient to and technically possible to reduce it further without any complications.
My sense on this one, and I don't know for sure, but my sense on this one is that they realized that that we're more sensitive to it than they thought initially, that there were enough studies that were coming up on the health effects that they realized that 50 was just too high, and they wanted to joke. I think this was driven by new information about the toxicity of it and the health effects of
then
it.
Then it really should be taken seriously.
Probably, yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things, of course, that you're going to want to know is how long. Has it been at 37 ppb? Is this a new problem, or I've been exposed to this for a long time? I mean, that's a piece of information that you're going to need to know in terms of it, because if it's a short-term exposure, it's probably not a big deal. It's the long-term exposure to levels like this that are important. Treatment options. It can be treated at the home. I mean, there are many different products that are out there, are, you know, different possibilities for being able to treat your water at home. Yeah.
Where does the statistical significance of all this stuff come in? I mean, you know, you could say something like, okay, one in a million or whatever is going to get cancer.
Mm-hmm.
Someone says, so what?
Yeah. Well,
I mean, you know, because
That's a genuine thing. You know, it's like you don't really know for sure if you're going to be the one in the million, and it's like, are you even going to be able to tell that if you got cancer that it came from arsenic? Probably not. You know, I mean, and so in some ways, you know, you could say that it's not worth worrying about it too much because there's too many other things that can happen in life.
Is there lower hanging fruit to benefit our health? Why put all the effort into this?
Yeah, well, that's a genuine perspective as well. I mean, one of the interesting things about it is synergistic effects. If you are a smoker and exposed to arsenic, you're much more likely to get lung cancer. There's a synergistic effect between the smoking and the arsenic thing that goes beyond either of them alone, which is kind of an interesting thing about this. Let me just sort of jump around here a little bit here too.
Is arsenic, I mean, is that one of the big issues right now in our world in the U.S.? Is that why you're kind of focusing on that? Or?
Is it a big issue? You know, there's so many of them out there. I don't know. This is one that's sort of been getting a lot of attention lately, and I'll show you a little bit more information probably about why it's been getting more attention. Periodic table of chemical elements. One of the interesting things about chemistry here is that everything up and down a row has got similar kinds of chemistry to it. Arsenic falls below phosphorus and nitrogen. Do you think those are kind of important in our bodies? That's one of the reasons why it's a concern and why it's such a problem with and why it can lead to cancers in so many ways and why it can lead to so many health effects is that it's got very similar chemistry in some ways to phosphorus in particular, and so it's actually competing with phosphorus in your system. And the nitrogen part, and so the reason, I mean, in order to cause cancer, you have to be able to interact with DNA, and disrupt DNA and replication and things like that too. And it's the fact that it's got this chemistry that's similar to phosphorus in particular, but also nitrogen that makes it get in there and compete with things and kind of mess things up in your system. So that's a little bit about the epidemiology of it. Treatment issues. Well, let me just go back to here. This is the United USGS map of the United States, and I'll just point out, so this 50 micrograms per liter in red, that's the 50 ppb. The level in orange, that's the current MCL of 10 ppb, 5 in yellow, 3 in that kind of greenish beige color, 1 in black. This kind of shows you one of the reasons why there's a focus on this in the United States. It's because it's everywhere. It's in water supplies all over the place. I mean, there's certain hot spots in here to pay attention to. I mean, California's got a few. Nevada's definitely got a bunch. It looks like Wisconsin, for the most part, is in pretty decent shape there in terms of the current MCL. But none of them actually meet the public health goal of zero, because of the, again, because of the geology of all these kinds of formations. So I guess that's one of the reasons why there's a focus on arsenic, is just because it's so prevalent.
What causes the hotspots?
Geology. Mm-hmm. Arsenopyrites. It's just a part of the geology. I mean, it's the same reason that you don't have gold deposits everywhere. You only have them somewhere. You don't have copper deposits everywhere. You only have them somewhere. And the same thing happens with arsenic as well. There's just some places where it's naturally concentrated in the mineralogy and other places where it's not. Yeah. So that's, you know, this is kind of an interesting thing. So how many of you guys live in western Minnesota? Any of you?
Years ago.
Yeah.
Eastern. What are those two areas in Minnesota? Do you happen to know?
I am not sure. I don't know. I don't know that answer. Yeah. But if you live in that area, then this gives you something to research.
Yeah.
But here in the United States, it's one thing. It's a real crisis in Bangladesh and West Bengal. It's spelled a little bit incorrectly there, but. So 0.05 milligrams per liter, that's again that 50 parts per billion thing. So in these regions here of the dark purple, that means 70 to 100% of all the water wells in that area exceed this 50 parts per billion. I mean, that's a pretty big swath of the country there that has this, and these are again natural formations. And unlike the United States, they don't have the wealth or the technology to go after this stuff. And another issue there is that it's everywhere, so it's in surface water, it's in groundwater, and so their choices are really to get water from, their choices are between waters with high levels or waters with lower levels, I mean, you know, but they can't get water that really meets the standards that they want to. And so there is a lot of issue here about trying to figure out how to deal with this in a third world country where they don't have the options for treatment that we do. You asked about treatment. Coagulation with iron, hydroxide, precipitants is one of them. That if you put iron in the water, if you mix a little bit of iron in the water and oxidize it, the iron will, when it oxidizes to iron 3, it will drop out and it will carry a lot of the arsenic with it. That's one of the ways that you can treat it. There are many different other ways. Another kind of, so in an area like this where they're looking for some low-tech ways, what's the right?
So that's pretty much the same process that they're going to use here to get rid of the toxicity really that's draining out of the tailings, except that instead of iron, they're going to use something else, right?
Lime.
Yeah,
something like that. There's not a lot of arsenic to worry about in this particular mine. I mean, which is kind of a shock, not a shock. It's a little bit surprising because arsenic in acid mine drainage does tend to be a problem, but for whatever reason, it doesn't seem to be such a big problem in this particular mine here. It seems to be rather trivial, which is kind of, I guess, one of the blessings. So equilibrating with iron filings is one of the ways that you can get rid of arsenic in water. It actually adsorbs onto the iron, and so you can pass water through these iron filings, and you can't get rid of it all, but you can get rid of quite a bit of it by passing it through iron filings. And so they're, you know, literally, they're, you know, one of the ways of trying to deal with it in Bangladesh here is to just, you know, build these containers full of nails, iron nails and things, and you pass the water through there, and you strip out enough of it that you get it to a healthier level. It's not going to be arsenic free, but it's a healthier level. You had a question?
Well, I'm just wondering, northern Minnesota, which is good, has a lot of iron ore deposits.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems to me that if you're in an area where naturally you have iron ore deposits, as in northern Wisconsin, then you would not have the chance of having arsenic present in high levels?
That seems to be, that's probably true. I haven't looked hard enough at that. Yeah. Go ahead.
Are you finished? I wanted to ask a question about this map.
Sure.
Bangladesh. thinking about their level of technology, then is it correct to assume that this is probably representative for the of the arsenic concentration in these water sources for the last hundreds of years? So this is maybe what people have been drinking for generations?
It's actually kind of, you know, it's an interesting, you know, I don't think that's actually true. So one of the things that was happening in Bangladesh is that most people were getting their water from surface water, which was better in terms of arsenic, but really bad in terms of many other kind of water quality issues, pathogens, bacteria kind of things too. So some technology came along to produce, to make what they call them tube wells, and I don't exactly know how these tube wells work, but it's a relatively inexpensive way of going down deep into the groundwater reservoirs to get water. And so they started putting in these tube wells all over Bangladesh in order to get clean bacteria-free water. So they were trying to tap into this water to avoid problems with surface water. And then it's later on that they realized that there was the problems of arsenic in this water as well. And so now, you know, it's like, well, what do you do? And so one of the, so that's kind of an interesting, you know, unintended consequences kind of problem in Bangladesh. And so one of the solutions that they're seriously talking about is getting people back off of well water, back on the surface water, but learning, coming up with different ways to treat the surface water to make that cleaner. And if they could make the surface water cleaner, then they could get away from a lot of these wells that are causing the problems.
Mm-hmm. What do they do with the iron nails after you... It seems to me that I might end up with an awful lot of jack iron.
I don't know what the answer to that is, too. And so, you know... I mean, there are other kind of technological problems too. You put these filters in these water treatment systems in a country like that, and it's like, well, how long do they last? I mean, that's another question too. And so one of the issues that they've been dealing with a lot of these iron filtration systems is something called breakthrough. And essentially what this means is that you keep pumping water through this stuff, and the arsenic is getting stripped out over time. But eventually, you've kind of used up reactive sites. And then the arsenic starts breaking through. Instead of reacting with the iron, instead of being absorbed onto the iron, it breaks through. And so there have been a lot of problems with that too, where, you know, they put these filters in place, but then at some point it starts to break through, and the follow-up is pretty poor as to when that happens and how that happens. And so folks will be using this water thinking that it's safe, but it's not. So that's kind of an issue that they're dealing with, the technology issue that they're having to deal with in these countries.
The home type RO units will deal with it, though?
What's that?
The home type RO, reverse osmosis units you can buy, will deal with it?
Yes, they would deal with it. Yeah, those will clean up the water pretty well. Yeah, it's an interesting kind of thing to be. This is getting a little bit off the track. You actually want water that has minerals in it. If you get pure water that has no minerals in it, it actually starts to strip the minerals out of your body. And so, you know, you can go too far the other way in getting too pure of water, which is kind of one of the reasons, you know, in my shop they installed an RO system in my down the hall from where I work there, and I. You know, I guess it was supposed to be for taste or something like that. I don't know what the reason was for it, but I still drink the tap water because I think I need to hang on to the minerals I have. That's just my personal thing.
That water is chemically very aggressive.
What's that?
That water is chemically aggressive.
Well, it's universal solvent. I mean, it's going to try to pull stuff out for sure.
I'm going to get on a tangent here, but
sure.
I was interested in...
Tangents are fun.
You know, a big source of new energy is being touted now is the whole fracking process, and uh-huh. natural gas. And there's been a lot of issues raised around water quality
right.
at the same time. I guess two questions. Is arsenic part of that in terms of stirring up things? And just generally speaking, what are some of the water quality issues they're facing?
Well, so where have they been doing the fracking? They've been doing the fracking like in Texas and North Dakota. Those are the big ones.
Pennsylvania. Yeah.
Yeah.
Western Pennsylvania.
I mean, judging from this map, I would say that it's probably not such a big problem for arsenic. It may be for some other things, but maybe not for arsenic so much. Yeah, that's my guess. Other questions or comments?
Fracking was exempt from the Clean Water Act at one point, and that's a big controversy now, and the companies are arguing that their formulas they use are proprietary.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's, yeah, emerging contaminants is a big...
They did have an exemption from the Clean Water Act, I believe, and that's...
You still do, I believe.
They still, yeah.
When did they start fracking? When did that come in place?
Well, it's just within the last 5 years it's really become a big thing.
Yeah.
Halliburton did a lot of the invention and development of it. It's comparatively new because in North Dakota it was a big issue. It was an election issue on the internet. Somebody said, well, there's all kinds of oil there, and they tied politics to it, so we're not getting it. But the real answer was the fracking hadn't developed to the point.
Fracking was going on 30 years ago, because I almost got employed by the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
No, Texaco. They told me some of the techniques they used, and at that time they very often used explosives.
Mm-hmm.
They would diesel a field to create the crushing force.
Yeah.
But it was great. Every time the whole earth would go up, guy made a mistake in his calculation. So people were playing around with it, but it was tricky.
Mm-hmm.
And now they've made a breakthrough and.
Yeah.
Commercially, but the technique has been around for quite a while.
Yeah. But the chemistry is there now that makes it work. Because the interesting thing, you're talking about filtering news. They said, well, there's more oil under there than there is in Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
The USGS website confirms that. It's just a question of, can you get it?
Yeah.
And now that's the technology they've developed now to get at it.
Yeah.
That's why we had a shortage of natural gas a few years ago, and now we got it coming out of our ears and burning it in every power plant, some people are saying.
Oh, okay, let me see what else I have here. You know, this is just another diagram here that shows a little bit of the issue with arsenic. So this particular graph here, these are these two well things, two well water samples. And so... what this shows here is kind of a graph of the percentage of wells that meet certain water quality slots here. So in Bangladesh, only 27% of these two wells have water that meet that 10 parts per billion MCL criteria. 14% are in the 10 to 50 range. And the highest here, 26% are in the 100 to 300 range in terms of how much arsenic they have in them. You know, but you've got some wells out there, 3%, that are 700 to 1,000. And at those kind of concentrations, you have to start worrying about some of the more acute effects, which are things like nausea and dizziness, things like that. West Bengal, it's a little bit better here that you've got almost half that meet this water quality criteria here. Up at the higher levels, it's not quite so bad. But still, there's a real, just genuine human health issue in these countries here that are exacerbated by the poverty levels. Let's see.
You started out asking how we would feel with our water or with lake water or with is water the only way that we should be concerned? I mean, ingesting it? I mean, can you inhale dust, or if you get it on your skin, does it absorb into your system, or...
The skin absorption isn't so much, but yes, inhalation is an issue, and consuming it with food is an issue. I mean, if you live in an area that's got that high deposits of arsenic in the soils, you know, then you need to be a little bit more concerned about other routes of exposure to it, yes.
So, I mean,
in general, you
might get it in the lettuce or the radish and...
Potentially, yeah.
Cow's milk?
Right. In general, I think the reason why... You know, drinking water tends to be the concern is because so many people get it from from groundwater. The drinking water sources are coming from groundwater, and that's kind of the biggest exposure route in terms of water is when you're going through these geologic formations. The water's had hundreds, if not thousands of years to sit there and dissolve arsenic and bring it into solution. So it's mostly a groundwater problem if you're getting your water from a groundwater system. But yes, if you live in some areas where the geology is particularly enriched in it, then you need to be concerned about some other exposure routes too.
I'm wondering, in our own area, radium is a big issue, but it's all because the aquifer, the water tables drop well over 500 feet in a comparatively short time, and
mm-hmm.
what's down there is becoming more and more concentrated.
Right.
The negative stuff.
Yeah. No, I guess that is an interesting, yeah. I don't really have, yeah.
Do they
question.
Report, if you buy bottled water, do they report the level of arsenic
it
this
won't
water
be,
comes from?
It won't be on the bottle, but in theory you can find it on a website. If you go to the company website there, you may be able to find. And it's not something that has to be reported to the FDA or to any federal regulators as well, so you kind of have to rely on just being able to find it on the website. They don't have to put it on their label.
Mm-hmm.
So unlike municipal water, where they have to send out a water report once a year, the bottled water companies are kind of can keep you in the dark unless you go digging for the information.
Yeah. Look at their public water supply.
What's that?
Look at their public water supply. A lot of them use that.
Yeah. No, that's the other point too, is that 40 to 70% of the bottled water you get comes from municipal water anyway, so.
Not very briefly, the environment, all those bottles to deal with unnecessarily.
Yeah. Anyway. So I don't have anything in particular else to talk about here with arsenic, unless you've got more questions about it. Or comments or anything.
I have another question.
Sure.
You're at the University of California at Davis.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a school of public health there?
We have a school of public health. I'm not sure about that for whatever reason. I mean, I know we got a medical school and a medical center and a vet center. I would I mean, it makes sense that there'd be public health there as well. It's just a different part of campus.
What kind of a relationship the Department of Geology? I assume that's what you're in.
I'm in a weird department called Land, Air, and Water Resources.
Okay, what kind of a relationship?
Earth, wind, and fire.
You would have two departments of public health who have, clearly a different point of view.
Right. So we don't interact with them quite so directly. I mean, we do a lot of work with the State Water Board, and this, and working with, the State Water Board is the arm of the EPA that regulates this. Water quality issues. So there's a lot of number of PIs in my department who get grants and who get research dollars from the State Water Board to do water quality issues like that. Public health, we're kind of insulated from that. We've got a Department of Environmental Toxicology, which I guess is maybe one step closer to the public health realm, and so we'll kind of work with the ETOX folks on some of these issues as well, but I think that they kind of jump over into the more of the policy side. There's some policy folks who work in
the
environmental toxicology.
What people take your class then? I mean, are they people that are going to be going into industry and trying to figure out ways to get around water quality, or are people that are interested in quality of life and health, or
so
what?
This particular class, it's through a science and society program, and so it's for lower division, so it's like mostly freshmen and sophomores. It's they're non-science majors, and so I look at them as a room full of voters, and that my job is to try to teach them environmental literacy. But I have had several folks in my class who've actually gotten jobs with the state based on the water quality, the policy kinds of things that they pick up in my class. So there are some that end up going that direction. The other thing that I guess I'm trying to do is to see if I can hook some of the non-science majors into a science major. So we've had some folks who've jumped into hydrology after taking my class as well.
Yeah. Do you have any science? You're teaching a course for non-scientists. Do you have a similar course for scientists?
For water quality, no, there didn't seem to be such a big demand. I do teach a class in aqueous geochemistry, which is geared towards hydrologists and geologists. That's at the upper division. So there's a juniors and seniors primarily, and then I get some graduate students in that one as well. We don't hit the water quality stuff so much. We just do water chemistry, speciation kinds of things. Yeah.
Are you the presenter that made a presentation on water, bottled water?
Yeah.
The water in the bottle and the bottle outside the water?
Yeah, that was me.
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry, I missed that. I'll have to try to think.
It's all right. I forgive you. Yeah. No, that's an interesting thing. I was seeing one of the stats that I didn't even remember to bring up in that particular presentation is that it takes about 4 liters of water to produce 1 liter of bottled water, just in the industrial processing of those things too. So it's kind of another one of those ironies of bottled water.
Of the impurities that you find in water, uh-huh. Where is arsenic rated? I mean, are there other, you know, mercury, is there a ranking of what gets most attention?
Oh, I don't know. It's a little bit.
Back to the function.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the, I mean, I think it's a little bit of the squeaky wheel syndrome, that whatever's getting the squeaky wheel will get the most attention at any given time. I mean, I think the reason why arsenic is such a big deal is because it is natural and it is everywhere. And so it's one of those things that tends to be consistently a little more elevated than a lot of other things that, you know, it's all over the country.
I think it's geographical, too, because,
yeah.
For example, in the county bordering ours, radium is a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah, right. There is some of those kind of issues as well. I mean, one of the things, you know, if you get your water from surface water, one of the hot emerging contaminant issues right now is disinfection byproducts. When you chlorinate water, you end up forming these halogenated compounds that are carcinogenic. Trihalomethanes, haloacetic acids are a couple of the classes of compounds that are regulated by the EPA. And when you get it from surface water, you've got high enough levels of dissolved organic matter in there that then it's an issue. If you get your water from groundwater, that's not going to be such a big concern because the organic matter content is a lot lower in those too. So groundwater, I think, is arsenic. Yeah, that's where you need to be worried about arsenic. If it's surface water, then you need to be worried about some other kinds of things. So it's
you're
geographical, it's water source, there's a different number of different things.
There seems to be a changing trend for public, like surface water purification, for lack of a better word, going to ozone as opposed to chlorine.
Ozone, you know, the problem with...
We do both in our municipality, but
yeah,
I'm reading literature now that they're leaning towards that direction.
Well, the problem with it, I mean, any kind of disinfection that you're going to do involves oxidation. And so, you know, even though you're using chlorine to oxidize water or oxidize your water and disinfect it, it's not like a direct reaction. Like all the chlorine that you goes on to the organic matter is coming from the chlorination stuff that you have. And one of the big concerns is that if you've got high bromine content in your water, when you chlorinate it, you actually form lots of brominated compounds. And so it's not a one-to-one relationship. It's not the chlorine from the chlorination that's causing the problem. It's a lot of times it's the halogens that are already in the water. And so bromine is a big problem. If your water has high bromine in there and you're chlorinating it, you have a bigger problem than if it does not. Just because it's, so when you ozonate it, when you still end up forming these disinfection byproducts because it's part of the oxidation process that happens that you get the organic matter combining with the halogens in the water. UV oxidation seems to be the kindest of the
that's
techniques.
That's what I was going to ask, comparatively speaking.
But there's a scaling issue with the UV oxidation there where it's been, you know, up to now anyway, it's been a little bit harder for them to get the right kind of scaling technique to be able to do it on a large scale.
And I suppose it depends a lot with the raw material you're dealing with.
Yeah.
In one situation, one method is better, another. But raw materials from a different source, you gotta.
Right. But water treatment plants, for you know, if there's a high level of dissolved organic carbon in their feedstock, they'll actually coagulate it out first. They'll try to get rid of it through coagulation before they ever send it through the disinfection process in order to reduce that potential. Yeah.
Has anybody asked how it interacts with old lace, or is that a rhetorical question?
I was actually thinking about doing some research on that, but I didn't. That's right. Yeah, I didn't get enough funding for that. My volunteer status here. Anyway, any other questions about anything?
What happens as you pull all of these materials out of the drinking water?
Mm-hmm.
You end up with concentrated materials. What happens with those? I mean, if you pull the arsenic out of the water somewhere, you've got a more potent concentration of arsenic, right?
Yeah, you know, I don't know what the disposal is. I mean, if it's here at Poland, apparently the sludge from the treatment plant, I mean, they're talking about putting that on top of the mine tailings and just collecting it there.
It's probably purer than the mine tailings.
Yeah.
Well, does it become an insoluble state when it's being spread over the tailings? It's not water soluble anymore?
Well, anything will dissolve to some extent in water.
But comparatively speaking,
yeah, comparatively speaking, I guess you're just slowing it down. It's got a less direct line to the water.
You brought up an interesting point in the countries where they're relying on desalinization.
Uh huh.
The collection there is a huge issue. After they've desalinated the minerals they've taken out of the water, where we're going to dump them?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess you could put them back in the ocean and call it good, but I'm not sure if that's what happens to them or not.
But there's sea here, you should say.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting water quality is a very very interesting topic to kind of watch for sure. And, you know, there's so many different varieties of water pollution issues as well, too. So you can kind of go find your particular flavor that you like the best, whether it's metals or organics or, you know, industrial chemicals or natural things like sediments, turbidity, pH. I don't know.
Just don't drink it.
What's that?
I said, just don't drink it. You'll be fine for a very short time.
Yeah. Well, you know, Chris Schultz assured us that the water here at Holden is very, very good, has high water quality, so you're safe here.
It is.
Yeah, so just stay long.
Thank you.
Equilibration just means that you give it enough time to let the reaction go through. It's a completion.
Okay. I'm worried that I'm completely unfamiliar with it. I'm going to find out.
Thank you. That's fine. Thanks, Barry. So, do most questions have something? I have a student from our church. Do most satisfies my general education requirements. There's a writing course, among other things too. So yeah, I mean I get 90 students at each time I teach it, 90 students once a year.
Okay.
So it's a triple header. It's three different general education requirements that we can fill.
Okay.
Which makes it appealing to a lot of folks.
And then you plan.
So science and society. That's the program that it's under.
Okay.
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 Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay. Okay.